speaking the truth cause the trouble to flow. What else can I do but stand up for my belief in the face of these mobs of politician thug thieves?
Still living on home, and so that's great.
Super. That's really cool that you help out with your mom. For a while, I took care or helped my mom, and it's one of the things that I admire about you, which gets me on to my second thing I was going to do. Thank you, like, really, from a person to a person, you've helped me in life. We've never met or talked before, but the ideas that you've expressed and your generosity with them across, like, a really wide space has really inspired me in a lot of ways to explore ideas that I never would have thought of or thought were, safe enough to explore. And, in general, just you've been, with your interviews and your podcast, you're just a voice that I've been able to find, when I needed to hear somebody.
Thanks so much. That means a lot to me.
Yeah. And so, as such, I'm trying to be similar to that, in the sense that I'm trying to be, you know, generous with my ideas and seeking out people, the people with the best ideas, the best people who write the best books, and try to get to the bottom of some questions that I feel in my personal life really isolated from anyone who can discuss these topics with me that are pretty much in, you know, your day-to-day, the things that in your podcasts and writings are...
How old are you?
I'm 41.
I had that, sorry to base this on age, but I had that problem in my 20s that I thought that if I talked about the things that were important to me that I would lose all my friends, and so I was afraid to talk about them. And then I did start talking about them, and I did lose all my friends. But I made a new set of friends.
Yeah, I guess that phase with me is taking a lot longer. I don't know. I did feel that when I was in my 20s, and I broke up with a girl who was really important to me because I just couldn't keep it all together. How I could be a political person and say the things loudly that I felt like needed to be said, but then how it would reflect in a relationship and her parents, what they would think, and how I'd build this life and stuff. And there was I lost all of those, that whole group of people, and they
seemed really hard. Yeah.
But I look back and I say how where I am now and all the stuff that I have done. I've explored the world. I've challenged what's possible for someone like myself. And I'm proud of a lot of the stuff that I've accomplished. Although it seems like it seems like the isolation is continuing. And that's, I guess, one of the things I wanted to get into. There's some stuff going on in the United States right now that I haven't been able to really discuss with anybody. Like my family, I've had to keep them posted, but I've gone to this summer. I went to some festivals and the Rainbow Gathering, and I've been traveling around national parks in Washington, Oregon, and I've just seen a lot of police state stuff that I've never seen before.
So have we started the interview?
I pretty much start the whole thing. That's the goal I'm trying to get to, like the whole conversation, minimal editing. And I understand if that's something that's uncomfortable to get into right away, but yeah. My podcast idea is The Surgeon, Not the Butcher. Like, that was a meditation teacher helped me. Like, as a comedian, I feel like I want to criticize people who are really mean and bad in a very mean and mean way. And my teacher suggested that I try and be the surgeon, not the butcher. So if I see a conflict or a big issue that I want to dive into, rather than, you know, jumping in, you know, just like swinging away, why not try and be like, let's look to the heart of the problem, the root, and really talk about. And I find that you do that in your writing. That's why you're one of the people I'd like to reach out to. On June 1st, I lost a job in March, like a corporate Silicon Valley job, and I haven't been able to find another one. And I didn't want to live in the Midwest anyway, and my family lives in the Northwest. And so I got rid of my apartment, and I packed up into my Honda CRV, and I've been living out of that since. And I thought I would go to these festivals, and I would meet people, and I would, you know, expand my network and stuff. And instead, I've found some really alarming things, and I've had some really alarming interactions with strangers who I don't think who they said they were. And I've looked into also what's happening, the DAPL movement, for instance, with the Tiger Swan stuff going on. And I think this is really a time for people who are trying to stand up to against the dominating culture, to be really vocal about what we're experiencing, because they're trying to, I believe, that they're trying to isolate us and minimize our voices in a lot of ways. And especially if it's anybody who even has liked a single post on the DAPL or whatever is being like sucked into some, you know, interstate manhunt or whatever that they're doing. I was wondering what you've heard about this and what, have you been affected? Have you seen this type of stuff?
So be a little bit more specific. I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Yeah. So, in my opinion, are you familiar at all with the Rainbow Gathering?
I've heard of them.
Sure. It's the idea the idea is kind of similar to like the New Testament or whatever. We're just going to gather in the National Forest and everybody who comes just bringing whatever food and we'll just have like a peace gathering, in the woods. And I've gone to them sporadically throughout my life, but the last 3 or 4 years I was like, I really think we need to go gather for peace. And I would be unemployed, and so I'd have the time to go do it, and so I'd go camp out. But as I gradually went to these things, I started to notice like things that looked more and more like police surveillance, and to the point where when I went this year, it seemed to me like the entire thing was just police arguing over who to arrest. And then after that, I went to the Oregon Country Fair, and I found a similar thing where there was a bunch of people who kept interacting with me that just clearly didn't add up. And then I've been at national parks and I've been at Walmart parking lots, and it just seems like I'm experiencing what appears to me to be a lot of undercover police who are trying to bait me into crimes. And they might be using like a really, I don't know, it's... Yeah, you can tell I'm having difficulty like sounding not a little bit alarmed and crazy about it. My family, I've told them that I think this is happening, and they're like, but you're not an important person. And I don't think you need to be now an important person to be harassed by law enforcement. I think that maybe if they've seen that you've tried to be a private person, if they've seen you try to be evade their surveillance technology, if they see that you're, I don't know, liked a Facebook thing about No DAPL, then you're just thrown in there, and they're going to, every time they see you, they're going to not just run your plates, but like this full psychological profile maybe of you. And then things start to get weird after that. And so I'm trying to reach out to other people in general, including like Chris Hedges, Barrett Brown, other people who I know have seen and encountered stuff like this. And because it's difficult for me emotionally, frankly.
So I mean that sounds very difficult. And what question do you want to ask me?
First of all, are you hearing other people experiencing the same stuff? And then like if we're going to be a public people and we're going to talk about ideas and take the risk that we're going to be surveilled and all right, there'd be like kind of a thought crime, thought police thing going on. How do we stand up to that?
Well, I know for myself that I wrote a book on surveillance called War from the Machine, and we understand that the way that the surveillance state wants to operate is through the model is sort of Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon, which is a prison design where it's a cylinder, and all of the cells are radiate out from the center, and the center is always kept dark and the cells are always kept lit, and the point is that then surveillance can be always possible and never verifiable. And what happens then is that the people, the prisoners start to basically police themselves. Right. You don't even have to have anybody in the center because it's not verifiable. And I think that that's a really interesting model, and so far as how it works, I think there's a couple of things. One is it's very clear that those in power will try to, they have in the past, and presumably are in the present, tried to trick people into doing things that then they they can be arrested for. And there was Eric McDavid, who was arrested and sentenced to, I think, 20 years or something. And the person who pushed the plan from the beginning was an FBI plant.
Yeah.
And the same thing has happened with some kid up in Portland, I think it was, who basically the
Republican National Convention thing, where here's some pipes, you know, maybe we should, you know.
No, this one was he was going to blow up a Christmas tree, a public Christmas tree.
Hmm.
And it ended up that the feds had approached him about the idea. He had expressed, you know, some sort of, I guess what I call it, jihadist views or something online. And then the feds, so it was like fishing. You know, the feds went fishing. And
right.
He did strike at the bait, but they still put out the bait and then they reeled him in. So that does happen. And then that's one side of it. And then the other side of it that we also, I think, is important to think about is it's really important not to give them powers that they don't actually have. And one thing that's helped me see my way through a lot of this is, oh, I'm going to switch phones here because I'm on a cordless and I'm hearing a little buzz, which I'm not suggesting, given this conversation, this is not surveillance, what it is, it's an old cordless phone.
Phone battery, okay, so yeah, can you switch?
So hold on, I'm going to switch and I'll continue with the topic. Oh, I still hear the buzz. Which still doesn't mean it's surveillance. The point is that I live in far northern California, and one county south of here is Humboldt, which is known for decades for being some of the best marijuana in the world. And so as a consequence, it ends up that in the town of Arcata, one house out of every five is a grow house.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're making it legal, but it wasn't legal before. My point is that they can't surveil everybody all the time, and we shouldn't give them more power than they actually have.
Mm.
So I think it's like when Eric McDavid was on trial, I got an email from his attorney saying, call me immediately. And I called him, and he said that the feds were using my name to try to smear Eric McDavid, and so just that I should be very careful. And I said, look, I'm a writer, you know, there has to be a firewall between above ground, below ground activities within any sort of surveillance state, and my job is to talk about these issues, and so, you know, I'm not talking about these issues by day, and then
right.
Blowing up stuff at night, that would be really foolish.
Hmm.
And so once I said that to him, and he was all calm. I don't know, here's another way to say this, is that I feel like a lot of this, okay, I'm going to say two more things. One of them is that it feels like the roving eye of Sauron from The Lord
of
the Rings.
Yeah, I tell that to my brothers. I'm like, it's the eye of Sauron.
If it falls on you, then you're screwed. And if it doesn't fall on you, then you can just go about your day. And you can, you know, carry the ring all the way to Mount Doom. And the other point to be made about this is, I mean, again, they attempt to surveil, and they attempt to get all the information they can, and technologically they can do more and more stuff. But that doesn't alter the fact that, have you ever... And this is not a political question. This is just an informational question. Have you ever, like, had your house burgled and then gone to the cops?
I have. My car broke and I went to the cops.
And did they magically catch the person?
No. One time they did with license plate reading technology. That was earlier this year, though. So that's recent. But
So anyway, my experience is that my place... Okay.
But usually, they just throw their hands up in the air and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So my point is that also, frankly, when you have, like, on a weekly basis, people going into public places and shooting people, And I mean, I think that they have much bigger fish to fry, as it were, than to worry about people who are just minding their own business and going around. That's not to say that nothing's going on at all. I'm just saying that, I mean, for God's sake, if here's another part of it, is that, let's say that they are actually investigating you and you haven't done anything. It's like, that is a tremendous waste of resources on their part.
I've thought about it that way, yeah. That if,
and if they are, I mean, then consider yourself doing good work, because that means that you're wasting, you're costing the surveillance state a lot more money than probably any action you could do. I mean, the whole thing ends up just being, I mean, I used to teach at a prison, and so I know that, like, I had this one student at the prison. He was doing the rest of his life for murder, and he had been arrested for, I think, a huge charge, maybe even murder, and he was released on a bureaucratic error that basically they signed the wrong person's name on a release, and he got out. This was, I mean, he was in jail before the trial. And then he was eventually caught in Utah. I said, why didn't you go to Mexico? I said, he said, I can't speak Spanish. I said, how did you get caught? And the way he got caught was, one day he had a flat tire, and a cop stopped to help him and to fix the tire. And he said the cop saw his prison tattoos and then, you know, called him in, and he got arrested, and now he's doing the rest of his life in prison. I said, man, that's really unlucky on your part. He said, no, it wasn't unlucky at all, because I had, like, $40,000 in cash in my waistband, and I had a gun in my ankle, you know, in my sock. And so the point is that he was living that lifestyle. Had he been, you know, just working construction or something, he wouldn't have been exposing himself to that. My point is, I think that there are a lot of people, and they can't surveil everybody. I mean, they can try, but they can't succeed at it. There's just too much information.
It seems like, I was watching this, there's a documentary, National Bird. I've started watching it, parsing it recently, and there's people they interview on there that are former Marines that are talking about the network that they used to work in, and there might be, like, military-grade networks surveilling, like, everything from above. And with the new Tiger Swan activity, and then I think about the new administration in office, which is, in my opinion, might as well just be a mafia, you know? How long is it until, you know, they start doing real dirty tricks and with these kind of resources?
Why would you say start? I mean, they've been doing dirty tricks all along.
Right. Things that, I guess what I've seen this year that made me really, like, I'm trying to get my friends away from Google and away from Facebook, and my family especially, away from these things, because I have these nieces and nephews. And if what's going to happen is, if our entire digital history is used then to make custom, like, law enforcement gambits to bait us into things later in our lives, then that adds this whole other dimension to the necessity of privacy at, like, all ages, not just for, like, us adults or us activists. If everybody's going to be swept into this, like, you know, the Utah data center, and there's a multiple ones like that, if they're, like, going to use this stuff in, like, kind of a Philip Dick, like, pre-crime Minority Report kind of way,
right,
and that's a whole different layer of, like, my brother said, oh, of course they're going to run your plates. Well, if they run your plates and their full psychological profile on you that's done, like, you know, that they've had time to put together on every single activist in the country, there's no way that's, you know, first of all, in line with, like, a right to privacy or anything that's freedom. But then, you know, like, it's really sick if you think about they're doing this to the children also. Like, as soon as you're, you know, you play your first video game on your mom's phone, it could be, you know, that they're looking for super geniuses, or they're looking for a certain or another type of personality. That's a really, you know, dark tinge to this that a lot of people are, that I've been warning about or thinking about might happen for years, but now I've seen it with my own eyes, in the sense that some of the stuff that I encountered at these places appears to me like it was tailor-made for someone like me. Like, they're dressing up like my ex-girlfriend or someone I had a problem with at work or something like that. Like, it's difficult for me to testify. I mean, I understand it's difficult to believe that I'm just one person that saw this, but there's a whole other layer for someone like myself who has, I have no publishing deals. I've just posted a bunch of stuff on, like, Reddit and Facebook. You know, I've, I am not making any money from my, radical, politics or something like this. I'm not an organizer. I don't have any followers. I'm just a guy with these accounts online, and I'm encountering this level of scrutiny, which, to me, it seems like it's a new development, like, because they know that who's in charge up at the top, and because they have control of Congress, both on all sides of Congress, the new judicial appointment, that what we're seeing in the first 6 months of 2017 could signal a much, a sea change that's going to affect a lot of people. And maybe I'm just saying this because I kind of want to share it with somebody, because, My family thinks I'm a little bit nuts. I'm not seeing anything, but my family's in the fence, I think. And so I just wanted to, I guess, let you know to be aware of that. That stuff seems to me to be amping up.
I think that's what the Panopticon does is amp up or ramp up. And I think that, sociologists have been talking about this for 100 and some years, about how the iron cages of modernity are closing in on us. And I think that this is generically the direction of society is for an increasing surveillance state.
So I know you've written about it a lot already, and it, you know, like, and I, you know, I thought about, you know, my other interviews I've heard of yours, and, you're correct. It all does go back to the land base. How does this really affect our ability to survive on the planet? Right. And another question that I had, I don't know what, I assume you're familiar with Guy McPherson and his, like, really grim prognosis, which I think we've all probably shared. I think about, like, I had designed, like, an eco-village, you know, that it would be neat if I had a piece of land. This is what I'd like to do with it. But now it's getting difficult for me to make any plan, like, for the surface of the Earth. I think more now about building underground or underwater or in outer space. To me, it seems like sharing even the surface of the Earth with these maniacs is going to be unfeasible. Have these developments, like Fukushima, or, you know, like, more threats of nuclear war, has that changed, like, any of your approach to, like, your planning for, a way of life that might, you know, be sustainable?
Well, no, because my perspective is always the same, which is that I need to, act in such a way as to make the land healthier on its own terms. And so I need to, it's like a friend of mine says, environmentalist friend John Osborne says, that we can't predict the future, but as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is if bull trout are still around in 20 years, they may still be around in 100, but if they're gone in 20, they're gone forever. So my emphasis is not on creating an eco-village or my emphasis is more on what do we do to stop this culture from killing the planet, and how do we protect the land? And no matter what we are, I mean, no matter what the future holds, my actions, I just got this question the other day from somebody asking how long I think until humans go extinct, and does that matter to my choices, whether they go extinct in 2100 or in 2030 or whatever? And I say, no, it doesn't, because I'm still going to protect salmon today, and I'm still going to work to remove dams today. And I'm still going to work to shut down capitalism and civilization today. That's the prognosis. And I mean, like, there's a sense in which if you're getting emphysema, what you should do is stop smoking. And it doesn't really matter whether it's early or late stage, unless it's final terminal. You know, if you're going to die in 3 days, then go ahead and smoke. But that's not just us that I'm concerned about. I'm not even primarily concerned about us. I'm primarily concerned about the non-humans. I'll do whatever it takes to maintain their survival.
Are you familiar at all with David Brin's science fiction trilogy or science fiction series, the Uplift series? Uplift trilogy? I think you might like it. The idea, basic idea is that there's a galactic civilization, and every type of species that we know on Earth, in one way or another, on some planet or another, has attained primacy. Like, so there'll be like a raccoon planet, there's like a broccoli planet. And then everywhere else in the universe, there's a federation of all these different species of beings. And then they discover Earth one day, and since no one, the other aspect of it is that if you, say, take dolphins, if we were to take dolphins on Earth and make them intelligent through breeding and training and whatever, then we would, when they became officially, in the galactic sense, sentient, they would be our servant species for like a 100,000 years or something like this. And then there's a galactic council, and when they discover Earth, they're like, what? Nobody made you sentient? You're just a bunch of apes that eventually figured it out on your own? We are, in the story series, then humans are then put to the top of the galactic council of all the species that have been the oldest and smartest species. And then you, that's like the, like, yeah, the, that's the civilization. All has to do with whether, who made your species sentient? And how long have they been sentient for? And your entire genetic code could be signed over to a different species on a, as part of a treaty or something like that. And there's this bird species that's like really evil and authoritarian or whatever. So that's how they make a story out of it. But that has affected kind of the way that it was, in a way, it helped me to enjoy the fact that my species is at least, you know, optimal, like marginally free here. And then to care more about, you know, other species and their inherent and potential intelligences. But then if I look at our planet with that type of scale, it seems like, I don't know, like we're tied to the mast of the ship on this crazy train. And so if I see someone that's capable of, like, you know, farming indoors, for instance, I think about, what if there were a spaceship traveling to someplace else, could it potentially be like a self-contained, you know, a self-contained, like, place, a living space for humans? And then I wonder, is there a way to, like, detach a car off the crazy train that might have solar panels, and then it might be isolated from some of the horrible things that happen?
If you're going to make solar panels, well, first off, I'm not really interested in detaching myself from the Earth. I mean, the Earth is the source of all life, and I can't see any reason to divorce myself from it, and I wouldn't want to, and it would also be extremely ungrateful to, since it is what gave me life. And so far as solar panels, my analysis is always very material in that, I mean, sure, spirituality is extremely important, but if you're going to have solar panels, they have to come from somewhere. And what do you, so where do you get the metal for the solar panels? Where do you get the sand for the solar panels? Where do you get,
so for,
how do you,
I've heard,
how do you, how do you, it's all part of the web of industrial society, and you can't have solar panels abstracted from the rest of industrial civilization. And it's the same with space travel, that there is this notion inherent in so much scientific thinking that, like, Elon Musk says that one of the signs of intelligence, one of the ways that they can look for intelligence around the universe, is look for planets with polluted atmospheres. Because if they have, that's actually how he defines intelligence, is the ability to make your atmosphere dirty. That's completely nuts. My definition of intelligence would be the capacity to live in place and to actually make your habitat better, not worse.
Like a harmony, symbiosis, yeah.
And so so my definition of intelligence is much different than that, and it would not, I mean, there's, what is it, the Dyson test or some sort of weird test from some science. I don't remember his name, but it's, it's searching for intelligent life in the universe and through radio waves or something. But building a radio is not sustainable, and it's because it's based on this industrial platform that can never be sustainable on a functional level. And so I think, I mean, and then there's more foundationally, I don't understand why we in this culture don't perceive redwood trees as intelligent, or we're only now starting to understand that octopuses are intelligent, and but the only way we will measure intelligence is by our own standards, and that seems very arrogant to me. It seems to me that I mean, I see no reason to believe that humans are fundamentally more intelligent than any other being on this planet. We have different forms of intelligence. A salmon would require different forms of intelligence and would evolve different forms of intelligence than a human would. But I think I don't see how it would work to say that we are more intelligent than they. But anyway, back to the original question. I hear what you're saying about developing a spaceship or developing something.
Any type of system to isolate us from the effects of this runaway culture that's going to, it's with the death urge.
But you can't, because this culture is killing the whole planet. And, I mean, even CBS News is saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish by 2050. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, if the fish go in the ocean, this is a water planet. And if the fish go, everybody goes. And if the phytoplankton goes, everybody goes.
Yeah.
And so it's not possible to isolate yourself from this runaway culture. Sure, we can separate ourselves insofar as, you know, I live in a forest and I can pretend. I used to think about this a lot when I would fly on tours a lot, that I'm living in this forest and that's great. And then as soon as I get an airplane to fly somewhere to do a talk, I'm flying over clear cuts and everything else, and it shatters the illusion that the world is somehow okay. And even in this beautiful forest here, even in the last 18 years that I've lived here, this populations of insects have collapsed, populations of migratory songbirds have collapsed, populations of almost everything have collapsed, bats have collapsed, all sorts of tiny beings have, even this one sort of beetle that I used to see all the time, even they have collapsed. Sow bug populations have collapsed. And so my point is that this forest here is fairly isolated and it's still okay, but nothing is not connected to the system. And when the system is killing the planet, then, I mean, nothing in nature is not interconnected. And then the same thing is true on a toxic mimic scale of the dominant culture, that on the ecological scale, you know, the collapse of salmon populations dramatically harms the populations of other beings who live in the forest, because it's a tremendous nutrient pump, among other things. Hmm. And then on the economic scale, I mean, look around right now. I mean, I'm holding in my hand a phone that was made in China, and I'm looking at a lamp made in China, and an alarm clock probably made in, you know, Indonesia or somewhere, I don't know. And
the fossil fuel cost is built into all that stuff, but you don't see it.
I'm sorry?
The fossil fuel cost is built into all that stuff, but there's no visible way to see that.
Exactly. And so I don't think we can isolate ourselves. It's like 20-some years ago, I was at this conference, I don't know what you call it, when there's a meeting of like 20 people who are writing a declaration. Okay. And we all are there. And there was a moderator ended the whole weekend with this exercise we're supposed to do, which is to pretend it's 20 years later, and it's 20 years later, and what he wanted is not from the past, and we somehow had become sustainable, and he wanted us to picture what it would look like and smell like and sound like. And people are talking about riding their bicycles and talking about all this other great stuff. And when it got to me, I said this really frustrates me for a couple reasons. One of them is that in your bicycle, where do you get the metal for the bicycle? You know, you can't make it in your little eco community. You have to have a mine in order to have metal for a bicycle.
And you gotta smelt it, and you gotta chop down a ton of trees. Now you're chopping down trees to make metal, and one person has the metal.
Exactly.
And then
the other thing I said is, what happens if we in our little village are able to start living sustainably, and we are all doing all these great things, and we're all really happy, and then those in power discover oil under our land? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen to our land and our community? So, sure, you can make an eco-community, and sure, we can have all these plans for this, but what we really need to do is to get rid of the whole system, because if there are resources on our land that they want, they're going to take them.
Yeah. So we can have these fanciful utopian ideas about, like, you know, it's one of the things I would enjoy discussing, maybe not today, but, you know, like, if you were to design a functioning government, it would have, like, maybe more branches, and one of the branches would take care, it would be responsible specifically for the ecology of the land that you're responsible for, as opposed to now, where there's, like, no voice for the environment that is the basis for everything.
Suppose they did sort of a toxic memory of that with the EPA, and...
Well, of course,
it was captured. It was captured very quickly.
But if it would nearly need, in order to actually have any power, it would have to be like at the same level as the judiciary branch. Like the judiciary and the legislative could not make a law that said, "Okay, we're going to clear cut this forest." There would be a whole other branch of government that would veto it, and that would, you know, immensely complexify government. But I've really tried to get my head around an idea where you can have in a human culture. That's based on, you know, language, I'm sure you've thought about this as well, considering, you know, your first book. These beings that have no way to speak inside of our culture, how do we let them be represented? And that ties into the whole capitalism issue, that capitalism doesn't pay for all its costs. And so if it doesn't show up at the table to argue or sue somebody in the course of production, then it's just forgotten completely as if the pollution was never emitted into the air.
Well, right now, an organization that I helped to found called Deep Green Resistance is participating in a lawsuit to try to assert that the Colorado River has rights, and it has certain inalienable rights, like the right to exist, and the entire natural community surrounding it has rights to exist. So I believe that you have to get rid of the entire system. But in the meantime, we're trying to do exactly what you're talking about with
representation of the national world.
Trying to pursue the notion that the Colorado River has the rights of any other being, any other what are currently in the United States given to human beings only.
I see. Yeah, that would, I mean, so we can, and there's a, are you familiar at all with the movie I Heart Huckabees, by any chance?
I heard of it, but I don't know what it's about at all.
It's helped me, it's a film that's helped me, it's kind of a, at the beginning, the Jason Schwartzman character is trying to defend like a marsh, like a whole marshland, and by the time Walmart and the city planners come back from the drawing board, there's like this single rock of the whole marshland that's going to be left after they pave over the whole place. And so the movie starts off with, you know, that, you know, from at least that standpoint, and then it's more about existentialism and transcendentalism and nihilism, those three. But I enjoyed I think you might enjoy it if you haven't seen it yet. It comes from, like, so you try and stand up for this one thing, or a handful of things that you as a single person can stand up for, like a river, or, you know, but... if it doesn't go well, you know, like how do you, the movie deals with that problem of how do you deal with it when you, you know, when you put all this effort into it and you still kind of get crapped on and you, I guess.
Well, that's what's going to happen. And then you dust yourself off and you get up and you fight again.
So I guess this is, I don't know, in my life right now, I'm picking raspberries in Cascadia. So I saw a few years ago the Occupied Cascadia movie. It really inspired me, and this is my third time to try and relocate out of the Midwest or where I grew up to either Washington or Oregon or Northern California, because I just really love it here. And And I'm having, you know, so I applied for a ton of IT jobs. You know, the way I've made most of my money in life is with information technology, system administration and network administration. And, but I've continually run into problems with corporate culture. And so I didn't find any jobs this summer, probably because my work history is so spotty or whatever. But I'm not, because of my beliefs, I'm not married to this, you know, tech life and living in the city anyway. So I saw this Craigslist ad. We need help picking raspberries in way out in the middle of nowhere. I'm not sure you get the Wenatchee River Valley. Are you familiar? Yeah. So I said, well, if I can't think of anything better to do, it's either take a part-time job at Costco or go pick berries in the middle of nowhere and then camp in the woods in my car. It's like no choice. It is obviously I'm going to go pick the raspberries. And so that's what I've been doing. And I've been, like learning about the culture here in this area, which is, it seemed, I don't know, you've probably been through areas like this where it seems like every third house is uninhabited and they're like rental vacation properties. And like, there's a lot of like mansions that no one's farming any of the land. And there's these big clear cuts where they're going to, you know, you just drive past them where they're going to put up yet more, you know, like mansion, like houses, McMansions or whatever. And here I am, you know, I'm working part time and I'm really enjoying getting my hands on the raspberries and being really a part of this woman who's really trying to farm. And she's never heard of DGR. She's never heard of you or Occupied Cascadia, but she has this family farm where she's really trying to live all the principles out. But I see the struggle that she's up against, with even getting a part-time worker to come pick her raspberries. Cause I'm treated kind of like a criminal everywhere I park, you know, no, you can't park here. No, you can't park here. You know? And, so I guess I feel like I'm trying to get back the land and there's just these just barriers that you can't do this.
Yeah. Well, things are stacked against laborers and things are stacked against, small family farmers. That's very, very true.
So I'm trying to communicate some of these principles to, say, this woman I work for who's been very kind to me, or my brothers who are bright guys, but they're in the ivory tower of the education sector. And so, like, the stuff I've seen in the corporate world where people are just mean and dishonest and backbiting, or the other stuff that intellectually I've seen it with my own eyes. I just know it to be true. For instance, your first premise of Endgame, that this is not a culture that's going to make a sustainable shift. And plus Guy McPherson stuff that, In a real scientific calculation that doesn't look like, you know, humanity is feasible. Like it does, like from a scientific perspective, appear as if we're facing extinction in the near term. And I'm not sure how far out. And like it's the same similar question you mentioned before. I know, but I mentioned Guy McPherson. I said to my sister-in-law, and I'm like, this guy has really, you need to hear, she has kids. And like, if she's going to plan for these kids' adult lives, she needs to hear what Guy McPherson is saying. And she just won't. She's overloaded. She's like, I've heard it all already. I mean, I'm so busy. I can't read anything else. I'm just overwhelmed. I can't hear any more bad news. How do you get through to people? Or what tips might you have that I could, you know, get people to look at these ideas that are so difficult and challenging?
Well, you're not going to like this, but people have asked me a lot, like, what do I talk to my family about? You know, what do I talk about over Thanksgiving or something? And I always just say football. You know, it's like, you can't... I remember reading something a long, long time ago that says it takes people 10 years to change their mind, and that made a lot of sense to me. And it's happened in my life. It's not usually 10 years, it's usually a few years. That I remember when I first encountered the notion that evolution is primarily based on cooperation as opposed to competition, and I at first thought that was crazy, and then within a couple, 3 years, I found myself no longer able to conceptualize how evolution can be based solely on competition. But so I did a 180 on it, but I didn't do it overnight. And so it doesn't, in my experience at least, it almost never does any good to actually argue with somebody. And so what I do is I just generally present a perspective, and if they don't like it, then we talk about
sports, you know, the weather,
sports or something else, and just, if that's if they're family. If they're not family, you know, if I don't have to talk to them, then I don't. You know, it's like I make small talk with the neighbors, but not very much. You know, I can chat with them about, oh, wow, there's a lot of potholes on the road, isn't there? But that's about it. And then I don't spend a lot of time with them. And then, you know, whenever I can, I mean, even with the neighbors, there was a bear who got trapped and killed last year. And I stated to everybody that I'm on the side of the natural world, that we are in, every time they bring it up, something about, oh, we're so scared because there's a bear in the neighborhood, I say, yes, it's the bear's neighborhood. The bears were here first. And so I make that point, but then I drop it. You know, I don't go, you know, that's all I can do, because they're not, because our worldviews are so different that, and again, it doesn't actually help to, you know, I'm not going to, one of my sisters is a petroleum engineer, and she and I can talk around the edges of this, but we can't talk about the core of it, in part because our values and perspectives are so different, and so I just find different people that I can talk about the issues that are important to me with.
So, like, that seems reasonable. Like, I wonder, like, in my life, I'm really trying to reach out and find the people that I can have these types of conversations with, and I just seem to run into all these obstacles, like when I go to a gathering and it's just like an undercover police festival. But other times, like, I know I've tried twice in my life to actually live in the eco-village, the unintentional community, and in the times that I did that, it was as if I don't know, like one egalitarian community I did the whole membership process in. At the end of it, I wrote this essay and said, I don't think any of you are egalitarians. I think that there's at least a quarter of you that are full on for like a hierarchical gangland style of a community here. And you're just kind of pretending to have this facade of an egalitarian community where everything's done on consensus. Whereas behind the scenes, what I see is a really rigid hierarchy where people are afraid to do like conflict resolution with this one person because he's too scary or something like that. And another place I went to was an eco-village where it turned out the people who built the place had enough money to do it, and then there's like 20 other people living there, and they're like begging the people who built the place for like work, like, could I like mow your lawn this week? I really need the hours, you know. And it turns into this kind of like a reverse unemployment type of situation where you're begging for the work, you know, to get your work hours. And I was wondering if you've seen any egalitarian communities out there, especially that might be accepting new members, that are actually working out, because the ones that I've checked out, it was like upside down world.
Well, that's not really a world that I know much about, and I'm such an introvert that I, you know, just stay by myself in a forest. I know some people who have had gone to various little eco-villages, and I know a couple who have had really good experiences, and I know a bunch of others who have had just dreadful experiences, and so I don't know of any, and I don't, and the reports I've gotten have been, as with yours, very mixed.
I see. Because it seems like such a good idea, but then also you're also susceptible to infiltration as well. Once you're there and have that land, you accept new members, then eventually there's a chance that you'll have, you know, well, that can't be something that scares you from doing it, but it's one of the complexities of the time.
I think in addition, it's really important to remember, it's very clear to me, in fact, I was just thinking about this earlier today, that humans are, I think, a fundamentally contentious species. I don't think we're evil. I think the selfish gene theory is all wrong. I don't agree with any of that. I don't think humans are a plague species, but I think we're fundamentally contentious. And I don't think it's just humans. I think this is true for, you know, songbirds. I think it's true for any social creature that they get a squabble. And I've always thought of something that Jeanette Armstrong, she's an Okanagan Indian writer and activist, said to me a long time ago, which is, you know, we in our community had to, we have the same problem as white people do, that we get in fights, you know, we get, this person gets mad at that person. But the big difference is that we recognize that my great-grandchild might marry your great-grandchild because we're living in place, we're planning on living in place for the next 500 years. So we have to figure out ways to get along. So they have formalized methods of conflict resolution that, and formalized methods of decision making. I think that two of the primary functions of any community should be to figure out how do we make communal decisions, and also how do we resolve disputes. And so I think, I mean, I remember in my early 20s, it suddenly occurred to me, and don't worry, I'm not a monarchist at all, but it suddenly occurred to me, I got the logic of monarchy, because it does seem, in a sense, really smart to have someone as your leader who has been trained from birth in how to be a leader. Now, of course, that's not really what happened with monarchies. What really happens with monarchies is that, you know, Brother John kills Brother Henry and takes the throne.
And then the 14-year-old, then a 14-year-old learns that they're going to be king someday, and there's no reason for him to even learn anything. He just realizes he can be a tyrant and just takes advantage of the system.
Well, there's that too. And that's why I'm really clear. I'm not proposing monarchy. All I'm saying is I can see the logic of it. I mean, there's two forms of logic. One is I want my kid to take the throne because I want the power to live on after me, and that's just crap.
Yeah.
But the other one I understand is training someone. It's like I asked Jeanette Armstrong, she's a healer, is one of the things she does, emotional, and she's a spiritual leader is what she is. And I said, when did you start doing your work? And she said, my parents knew I was going to do this work before I was born, and my mother ate certain foods that would start me in this direction. And my point is that her whole life she has been trained to be a facilitator, to facilitate conflict resolution, to be a spiritual seeker. And that makes a lot of sense to me, to train people from early on one level. And my whole point here is that we can have a myriad ways of societies and communities being organized, but I think that they're fundamental. The fundamental questions come down to, you know, how are decisions made and how are conflicts resolved?
So there's a lot of different ways to skin that cat, but it's the crux of the matter. So that leads, I filled up pages and pages of stuff I could potentially, you know, ask you about or talk with you about, but it's actually heading in, like, I see a path through. So I actually have been working on three rules that I use to deal with other people, and I think that has a tangency then to conflict resolution and in general decision making. I just wanted to run them by you and see what you thought of them, like, cause
sure. And then after that I should probably go.
All right. Sure. The first rule is do what you say you're gonna do.
I'm sorry, what?
Do what you say you're gonna do, the first rule.
Okay.
The second rule is do not be manipulative. And the third rule is respect the time, space, and ideas of other beings.
That makes perfect sense.
And I've been doing pretty well with that. Not just, I mean, it's much harder to do these things than it seems. They sound really simple. But I have found that if nothing else, it's helped me identify people who I don't want to be friends with really quickly.
Because people, well, that's great, and that's an incredibly important skill to have gained.
And so you would, so I wonder, you know, I think about the Ten Commandments, right? And there's not even a single thing in there that could relate, I think, to sexual violence, for instance. And in the respect the time, space, and ideas of other people, you could build in, you know, like in corollaries that could address you know, a ton of other things. And it comes to the right attitude of, you know, that where my freedom ends, where yours begins. And that's where a lot of the discussion takes place. Well, gosh, you've been really generous with your time and, you know, shared a lot of ideas with me. And I've been really trying to, make a good interview and ask questions that will provide information for everybody, not just me.
Well, your questions are great. Thank you.
Yeah. So thanks so much for your time. I'll try and post this on Radio for All as soon as I can. And I hope to interview you again sometime.
That'd be great.
All right. Thanks a lot, Derek. You have a great day.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Speaking the truth caused the trouble to flow. What else can I do but stand up for my belief in the face of these mobs of politician thug thieves?